Good afternoon. Let's call this meeting of the Senate State Affairs Committee to order. Please silence your cell phones. It is approximately 3:31 p.m. on Thursday, February 9th. Let the record show we have a quorum. We have Senator Egan, Senator Giesel, Senator Wilson, myself, Senator Dunleavy, Senator Coghill should be here momentarily. We're going to hear two bills. SB 5, Political Contributions Limits Prohibition, by a prime sponsor, Senator Meyer. We had this bill introduced last week, and we'll be hearing it again here today. And then we will have an introduction of SJR 1, Constitutional Amendment Guaranteed Permanent Fund Dividend, prime sponsor, Senator Wilkowski. So with that, we previously heard SB 5 on Tuesday, January 31st. Let the record reflect that Senator Coghill is here at 3:32 p.m. No problem. With SB 5 political contributions, there is a zero fiscal note attached. And at this point, I'll open up public testimony on SB 5. Is there anyone online that wishes to testify on SB 5? So I don't believe that's for SB 5. That's SB 1. Is there anyone online for SB 5? We can take just a brief of these. So once again, we're back online, and we are in session. And we are talking about SB 5, Political Contributions Limit Prohibition. We have public testimony open. Online, we have Andre McLeod from Anchorage. Are you online?
Yes.
Could you please identify yourself for the record and begin your testimony and estimate about 3 minutes?
Thank you. My name is Andre McLeod. I am from Anchorage, Alaska. I'm in support of SB 5. I think it's a terrific bill and will close a loophole in tax by legislators. There's a reason why back in 1996 with the Campaign Reform Act that they prohibited lobbyists from certain activities. The Article 1 of the Legislative Declaration of Lobbying finds and declares that the operation of responsible representative democracy requires that the fullest opportunity be afforded to the people to petition their government, and so lobbyists have a right to do what they do. They do a good job, some of them, and some of them not so good. But most of them adhere to the rules. They have reports to fill out and fees to pay. And they do a good job doing it, and all is well. But now, all of a sudden, we've got this kind of extortion scheme that has totally corrupted the system. And extortion is the practice of obtaining something, especially money, through force or threats. And lobbyists are people too. You know, they deserve respect. They do provide a very important service to you, to the public, and to government and the legislative process as a whole. And this extortion scheme that has been brought up by, let's say, Gabby's PAC is pretty bad and totally corrupts the process. If it's true that there are high and moral and ethical standards among public servants in the legislative branch, and it's important to assure the trust, respect, and confidence of the people, and if it's true that a fair and open government requires that legislators conduct the public's business in a manner that preserves the integrity of the process and avoids conflicts of interest or even appearances of conflicts of interest, and if it's true that in order for the rules governing conduct to be respected, the code must be administered fairly without bias or favoritism, then you need to pass SB 5. From what I understand, there has been some heavy leaning on legislators by the rules chair, and this is what makes it even more egregious of Gabby's PAC and allowing it to continue the way it's on its path. You have a rules chair who controls the door of the bills that go on the floor. And the Ethics Act says that an employee, a legislator, may not, through inference or anything else, threaten, state or imply that they will take or withhold a legislative action, including support or opposition to a bill, as a result of a person's decision to provide or not provide a political contribution. Well, you know, I think anybody who's been a rules chair understands the nuances. And from what I understand, there has been some really heavy leaning on these lobbyists. So you've already got corruption going on, and this has got to stop immediately. Please pass SB 5. Do whatever you have to do to close the loopholes. Do not leave any ambiguities in any definitions of what a group is. Please, for the sake of a good government, pass this bill. If you leave this unchecked, dysfunction and corruption ensues. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Online, we also have Tom Lucas with APOC. He's online if there's questions for members of the committee. Are there questions for members of the committee at this point for Mr. Lucas? Seeing none. Is there any additional testimony? Are there any other folks that wish to sign up and testify in the audience here in Juneau? Seeing none, we're going to close public testimony at this point. I'm going to take just a brief at ease as well. Back in session, State Affairs Committee is out of recess and back in session. We now have before us Senator Meyer, who's the prime sponsor of this bill. Senator Meyer, would you like to make any closing statements?
Well, thank you, Chairman Dunleavy and members of the committee. Again, for the record, my name is Senator Meyer, and I represent the southeast part of Anchorage, District M. And I would only like to add the following comments to this bill, Senate Bill 5. You have heard it, and you've heard the testimony. The purpose of this legislation is to break as little new ground as possible. We're not trying to do a comprehensive restructuring or overhaul of our campaign finance laws. And we're not trying to prohibit legislators from forming PACs. They'll still be able to do that under this legislation. We only want to address the loophole that came to everyone's attention last fall during the election process and put some sideboards on legislator-controlled groups. This was obviously brought to our attention in Anchorage by the Anchorage Daily News. And the Democrat Party took action and filed a complaint to APOC. And others, too, have voiced concern and complaints about this. And I think all of us should be concerned about it as well, because it does kind of taint the whole process, especially down here in Juneau. These groups that have PACs, or these legislators that have the PACs, should operate in line with how other elected officials are required, you know, ourselves. We cannot take contributions while we're in session. And we cannot take them from lobbyists unless that lobbyist lives in our district. So basically, Senate Bill 5 does two things. It disallows lobbyist contributions, except lobbyists can still contribute to candidates in their home district. And it prevents fundraising and expenditure activity during the legislative session. So that's basically all it does, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for hearing the bill.
Thank you, Senator Meyer. Are there any questions for the senator? Seeing none, is there a motion to move SB 5?
Mr. Chairman, I move the committee substitute for Senate Bill Number 5, version LS0112/Omega, with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal note.
Thank you. Are there any objections to moving the bill? Seeing none, the bill will be moved on to the next committee of referral. We'll take a brief at ease to sign the documents. Thank you. Back in session, we now turn to the next bill. It's actually a Senate Joint Resolution. This is Senate Joint Resolution 1. It is before the committee. It's sponsored by Senator Wilkowski. We have Senator Wilkowski and staff ready to present. Can you identify yourselves for the record and introduce your bill, or your resolution, and begin your testimony?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bill Wilikowski. I'm a state senator representing East Anchorage and Jay Bear, and with me is my chief of staff, Thomas Presley. Thank you. Mr. Chairman, this resolution would put a vote to the people of Alaska asking whether to put the permanent fund dividend and inflation proofing into the Alaska Constitution. Why put the PFD in the Constitution? Well, I think fundamentally this is the only way to truly protect the dividend and the corpus. We've heard for the last year that we need to restructure the permanent fund in order to protect the dividend. I'm not going to get into the merits of that, but I'll just say a few things about that. What we've learned recently is the only way to truly protect the dividend is to put it in the Constitution. I think many Alaskans were shocked when the governor cut everyone's PFD by over $1,000 last year with the stroke of his pen. This veto is the subject of a lawsuit, but the reality remains that if the Supreme Court upholds the Superior Court decision, then any future governor can veto the permanent fund dividend down to whatever level he or she chooses. The governor has proposed a bill known as the Permanent Fund Protection Act. That bill would restructure the permanent fund and permanently reduce the PFD amount to roughly $1,000. But contrary to the name of the bill, there is absolutely no protection for the dividend if the court accepts the governor's interpretation of the law. The legislature could pass the Permanent Fund Protection Act in April of this year, and the governor could veto that amount, the promised amount, from $1,000 down to $500 a month later if he chooses, or even a zero if he chooses. In fact, under the Permanent Fund Protection Act, under the governor's interpretation of the law, any future governor could veto the permanent fund dividend down to whatever level he or she chooses. There is absolutely no protection for the permanent fund dividend under this bill or any other bill that's currently going through this building. Even assuming the Supreme Court reverses the Superior Court decision and says the governor cannot veto the PFD, the PFD is still subject to the whim of the legislature and future legislatures who can currently legally change the amount of the PFD or eliminate the PFD at any time. I don't think many Alaskans realize that. So the absolute only way to protect the permanent fund dividend is to put it in the Constitution, and that's what this resolution provides. It's important to remember that the PFD reflects Alaskans' ownership share in our oil wealth. While the current value of the Alaska Permanent Fund is $56.4 billion as of yesterday, it's important to put this amount into perspective. Article 9, Section 15 of the Alaska Constitution requires that at least 25% of mineral lease rentals, royalties, royalty sale proceeds, and federal mineral revenue sharing payments and bonuses received by the state go into the permanent fund. We have passed a statute that says 50% of royalties for certain fields after a certain year go into the permanent fund, but this is a relatively small amount. In the whole scheme of revenue received by the state, the amount of revenue into the permanent fund is a very small amount. And I'll just give you some numbers to reflect this. 100% of state property taxes go to the government. 100% of corporate income taxes go to government. 100% of production taxes go to government. The state typically gets a 12.5% ownership share or royalty for our oil. Of that, 75% goes to government. That means 3.125% of our ownership share goes to Alaskans. Of all the revenue that's generated from all of our taxes, corporate income taxes, severance taxes, royalties, Alaskans get 3.125% of our ownership share. Of the roughly $527 billion in oil that's flowed down the pipeline, approximately 5% has gone into the Alaska Permanent Fund. Much has been said about the impact of the PFD on individuals, businesses, and our economy. I won't get too deeply into it, Mr. Chair, but I'll just will mention a couple points that I think are really critical. According to ICER, a recent study that they did, tens of thousands of Alaskans are removed from poverty because of the PFD. Alaska has the lowest income inequality in the United States because of the PFD. And according to ICER, the PFD creates thousands of jobs in Alaska. Very briefly on inflation proofing, one of the people who was very instrumental in the creation of the permanent fund and the dividend program was Elmer Rasmussen. And he referred to inflation as, quote, that thief in the night. Inflation proofing is responsible for a large portion of the current value of the permanent fund. I believe we should continue to protect the corpus by inflation proofing. There are three essential statutes that create the permanent fund dividend program: AS 3713-145, AS 3713-140, AS 4323-025. Under this resolution, these statutes are essentially put into the Constitution to constitutionally require that the PFD be paid at its current formula and that inflation proofing continue. That's all for my presentation, Mr. Chairman. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Are there any questions at this time for Senator Wilkowski related to SJR1? Senator Coghill.
Probably don't have to answer them now, Senator, but probably some of the questions that will arise from my perspective is this will be breaking new ground in that a constitutional right is going to be established rather than a statutory entitlement. And there's got to be some precedent for that, so I would be looking for some way to establish that precedent. Certainly the dividend has gone out to people based on our ability to share that wealth. But when you start talking about a constitutional right to the benefit of the resources, then I would start looking at other resources if it's a constitutional right. So just I don't have the question formulated right now, but that's right off the top of my head. And then I think the inflation proofing question, and you might have ready answers for it, was said when we were almost entirely under bonds instead of prudent investor. So just some description of those to help us think through if inflation proofing is at the right level right now.
Thank you. Do you wish to respond at this time, Senator?
Well, I'll take a crack at it, and then I'm happy to try to get additional responses. So,
Senator Wilkowski for the record.
Yes, Senator Wilkowski. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So just this does nothing other than what we are currently doing statutorily. This just simply puts the current formula in the Constitution. It does change the way we inflation proof. There currently is a formula in the statutes at AS 3713-145 that talks about exactly how inflation proofing should be done. It's a pretty lengthy section, and we didn't want to include such a lengthy section in the Constitution. So what we said in our constitutional amendment was simply that the legislature shall provide for inflation proofing. So the legislature would still have the discretion to determine what the level of inflation proofing would be. That being said, it doesn't change. It puts the earnings reserve account in the Constitution, but it doesn't change the ability of the legislature to still continue to use the excess revenue that's in the earnings reserve. And we have run some numbers, Mr. Chairman, and I'll just give you some very brief, because I know there's a lot of discussion in the building about, well, can we do this and still afford to pay out some revenue? My staff has created a rough spreadsheet, and we're running it through the Permanent Fund Corporation to make sure it's accurate. But by our calculations, under the current formula and under the way we're proposing to do this, assuming a rate of return of 6.75% and assuming a rate of inflation of 2.2%, which I think is a little bit generous, at least at today's numbers, you can use $1 billion per year to provide for government services in excess revenue if you choose, still provide for inflation proofing, still provide for the same level of dividend that we have, and provide $1 billion to the government. So, and in fact, what would happen to the level of your earnings reserve is it would actually rise slightly. So we think this allows for, if the government chooses, if the concern is still there that we want to use a small portion or a portion of $1 billion is certainly not a small portion, that the legislature would still have the ability to do that.
Follow up, Senator?
Yeah, and then one of the other questions I'll get, and I'll do a little bit of studying on it myself. I've thought about it, but I haven't really fleshed it out. The other thing is, if we put the formula in the Constitution that is presently used, using some of the earnings from the Permanent Fund has some impact then on what is available for payout. So the tension is going to be between the right of a dividend and the methodology of what's available. Have you thought about how that tension is going to be resolved?
The way we have the statute or the constitutional provision, Mr. Chairman. I'm Senator Bill Walkowski for the record. We try to track it as closely as possible to the current statutory formula. We do have a provision in Section 2 that says that actually sort of clarifies. If you go to line 10 of page 2, it says, on the last day of each fiscal year, 50% of the income available for distribution calculated under this subsection, or the balance in the account, whichever is less. Those words are actually new words. Those words are not in the statute right now, or the balance in the account, whichever is less. And so this actually clarifies some language that's a little bit of ambiguity, I think, that exists in our current statute, in that it says if you don't have the funds to provide a full dividend, then you can only provide what funds you actually have. And that's a little bit unclear right now. Fortunately, in the decades we've had this provision, we know that it's never run, we've never had a problem with it. We've never not been able to pay out a dividend. We've come close a couple times. We've never not been able to inflation proof. And so we do have a little bit of, well, we've got 30 plus years, 40 years of almost of paying out dividends, and we've never run out of money. We've fortunately never been in that situation. So we do know that there is certainly some decades of precedent for knowing that we'll have some funds available. The current projections by the Permanent Fund Corporation are that we will continue to receive about 6.75% rate of return, actually a little bit higher than that. I think it's closer to 7%. But under our estimates, we're projecting 6.75%. And you can do the math. If you have $57 billion, roughly, $56 billion, you multiply that by 6.75%, and that should be the amount that you have available every year. Remembering, though, that you still have a large, pretty large earnings reserve balance. And so what we did was we said, well, what's our earnings reserve balance today? And I think it's around $8.4 billion. Assuming that you continue to earn 6.75% every year, and of course that'll be higher and lower in certain years, assuming that you have a 2.2% inflation, and assuming that you draw $1 billion every year for government, you maintain your $10 billion. It actually increases slightly to $11 billion according to our calculations. So you can maintain a significant cushion in your earnings reserve. And I think what the Permanent Fund Corporation would like to do, and what the governor would like to do, is keep four times the cushion, and so that's around $10 to $11 billion. So we think you can keep that with the current formula at $1 billion. The question becomes, how much do you want to draw from the Permanent Fund? And if it's more than $1 billion, that's where you start to run into maybe some issues. You won't have the four times cushion, but maybe get a little bit of a less cushion.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator.
My understanding, though, is if you take any draw from the earnings reserve, that it's an impact under the formula to what a payout number finally is. So it's just the nature of the calculation, because it takes into account the whole earnings reserve account as far as a payout goes. And you reduce that in any given year, then that messes up the calculate, or it reduces the calculation for the final number the next year. And so that's what I was thinking. If you create a constitutional right, then that tension is going to be the government can use so much, and then you have a constitutional right to a dividend. You know, how does that play out? Would you ever use then any of the earnings reserve at that point? And that's kind of what I was thinking.
Mr. Chairman, Bill Walkowski, it's a fair point. Any draw from the earnings reserve will decrease the future dividends. That is a simple fact. And so any plan that's going through the building, the governor's plan, Senator Stedman's plan, any plan that uses any of the earnings reserve will ultimately result in reduced dividends.
Yeah, and Mr. Chairman, I'll only just say, because we're establishing a constitutional right, then that just changes the whole level of how you deal with it. And so I'm pondering that right now, that's all.
Yeah. And again, the purpose of this bill is not to advocate for using the earnings reserve, but I know that's a concern that many people have, and many people support that, and I just want to say you can do both. I'd like to, and I think the reason is it's really a matter of trust. I think for the Alaskan people, they have a lot of concerns about government coming in and restructuring the permanent fund this year. However we do it, maybe we keep it at $1,500 or $1,800 or $1,000. The fear and concern that people have is we'll be back in a few years. We'll be back in 5 years. We'll be back in 10 years, and be back for the rest. And the other fear is that they're subject to a veto, and the other fear is that it's subject to legislative change. And so So I think if there is to be any sort of change to the permanent fund, I think to establish trust with the people of Alaska to do that, you should protect it. We should put it in the Constitution. Figure out what that number is. I proposed this because this is our current formula. It could be a different formula, but I think it's important to establish that trust with the people by setting something in the Constitution that says, look, here, we're protecting, we're giving you some consistency, some stability, and protecting that.
One last question, Mr. Chairman.
Senator.
And then I'm asking these because I'm going to be doing some searching anyway. But and then probably for the first time, we will establish a constitutional right for an individual benefit that is highly targeted. And I wonder how IRS will see that, what our tax liability becomes. And so if you've thought about that, maybe there's some input that we can get on the record.
I thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator, through the chair. Again, Bill Wilkowski. I have thought about that, and that was a concern that was expressed to me. I have a legal opinion that was provided to the former Attorney General, Greg Rehnquist, by a law firm out of D.C., Steptoe and Johnson, and it's a pretty comprehensive opinion. I can provide it to the committee, Mr. Chair. And this is the only opinion that I have. I've heard there may be other opinions out there, but what this opinion says is that they don't think it would have any impact on our IRS tax-free status. It's my understanding there may be an opinion that says otherwise, but I have not seen that.
Thank you. Questions from members of the committee? So it would constitutionalize the decades-old calculations.
Yes.
Okay. And the decades-old calculation was interrupted last year with the veto. It was kind of opinion. There was an understanding for decades that this would occur, the calculation would be left alone, and last year that calculation was interrupted, and as a result, there's questions as to whether the dividend and the fund itself are now protected. You're trying to protect it through constitutionalizing it.
Mr. Chairman, I've thought about other ways that you could possibly do it. I can't think of any other way you can lock, stock, and barrel protect the dividend other than putting it in the Constitution. You can't pass a statute because you can't bind future legislatures from changing it. I think many people, I certainly had thought all along that this was when they created the permanent fund, they were creating a dedicated fund which allowed for a dedicated stream of income, which means that the governor couldn't veto it. There's a Supreme Court case, we think that's directly on point, Hickel versus Cooper, that will be decided in some time, but which says this is not an appropriation, that the dividend, the transfer of the funds from the earnings reserve account to the dividend fund is not an appropriation. The transfer of funds from the earnings reserve account for inflation proofing is not an appropriation. That's what the court has previously held. And if it's not an appropriation, it can't be vetoed by the governor. So we feel pretty strongly about that, but you never know what the courts will do. And this is the only way that you, if you want to truly protect it, if truly protecting the permanent fund is where the legislature wants to go, this is the only way that you can do it.
Thank you. We're going to open this up for public testimony in just a minute. Just one last comment for us to ponder. I found this interesting throughout this whole process. For years, the dividend would vary based upon the market conditions and the calculation. One year we'd have it at $700, you might have it at $900 the next year. When I review those records, and if I recall, I've been here since 83, I never can recall a time when the people of Alaska complained about the dividend. They just accepted the calculations. And the only time I saw the people really get up in arms was this past year with the veto. Somebody said something interesting, and it's anecdotal, and I'll move on after this and open it up for public testimony. But, and this was coming from somebody that, a couple that actually is well-to-do. I'm sorry, it's invited testimony, not public testimony. We're going to be opening in just a moment. But anyway, they said, did you notice that people got upset when the dividend was vetoed? That they never got upset before when the market determined the outcome. And I said, that is interesting. Why do you think that was? And they said, because government put their hands inside of this process, and that's what really set people off. And it was something for me to think about. In any event, we're going to open it up for invited testimony, then we'll have more discussion about the bill after invited testimony. We'll probably put it off the side, like I said, and we'll discuss this more. So at this point, we're going to open this up for invited testimony. Is retired Senator Halford online?
Yes, I am.
Could you please identify yourself for the record, Senator? And we're going to give you, if it's okay, we're going to give you 5 minutes, and you can begin your testimony.
Okay. I'm Rick Halford. I served there for a long time. I was a very slow learner. I happened to be the majority leader in 1982 on the House side when the permanent fund dividend passed. I expect I made the procedural motions, and I know I supported it. As soon as the Hammond administration was over, the Sheffield administration came in, and there became a lot of questions. There was an effort through the Sheffield campaign to repeal the dividend, and Governor Sheffield had second thoughts about that before he instituted it, but he did start the process of appropriating for the dividends. The only dividend that needed to be appropriated, of course, was the first dividend because it came from the general fund. The permanent fund hadn't made any money yet, and that first dividend was $1,000 or probably $2,500 or $3,000 in today's dollars. But following Governor Sheffield, Governor Cooper proposed cutting the permanent fund in half for an education endowment, and its value today, of course, would have been about half. Then Governor Hickel and Governor Knowles both came in with interest in alternative uses of the permanent fund, but they had both made commitments to former Governor Hammond that they would put any question like that on the ballot, and of course Governor Knowles did unsuccessfully. Then it went to Senator Murkowski, became governor, and he held the citizens' meeting in Fairbanks on what to do with the permanent fund, and the question at the time was, should excess earnings of the permanent fund be used for government? And after a pretty lengthy set of meetings with some very well-chosen people, there were a lot of people there, but they came up with a proposal for a constitutional change that would have been putting the dividend in the Constitution as well as changing to a permutation of a percent of market value. But until this last year, when the dividend was severed from the fund by veto, no one had ever thought that that was even a question. Those of us who were involved originally didn't care if the budget showed the permanent fund amount, but we always knew that it was a dedication specifically provided for by the last five or six words in the constitutional amendment that created the permanent fund, which said the income of the fund shall be deposited in the general fund unless otherwise provided by law. So unlike the other dedications or the other appropriation subject actions you take, such as tax credits, where it says subject to appropriation, there's nothing in the inflation proofing or the dividend that requires appropriation. That is the court case we're in. But in terms of how you get there, and I thought Senator Coghill asked some good questions, I'd be interested in responding if he wanted to repeat them, because I think those are real questions, and I think there are ways to deal with that. But the bottom line is the dividend connects individual Alaskans to the performance of their permanent fund with a sense of pride, empowerment, and responsibility. The permanent fund is unique in all the world for its success in terms of resource-rich, exploited countries. The World Bank, top economists, authors, and many, many examples cite it as the best way that a region has dealt with short-term resources. There were lots and lots of opponents to the creation of the permanent fund. It passed with a third of the people against it. It had a lot of political leadership against it. And through the entire time that we've been, it's been under attack whenever we were short of money. But one of the things that is the most important, probably the most important, to the success of the fund has been the connection between the permanent fund dividend and the fund. It's through the dividend that you individualize the impact of public choices to make it a loan package, to make it a mega project fund, to reduce this or change that. And authorities all the way up to the CIA's World Factbook say that people in Alaska know more about their fund than anybody else in the world. Dave Rose, the first executive director in his book, Savings from the Future, said, the goal of truly permanent savings of resource wealth is just short of impossible. He wrote of vaults within vaults and said it requires layers of protection to block the intense temptations of very powerful people. And he went on to say that the strongest defense of all for the Alaska Permanent Fund was the Alaska Permanent Fund dividend. I think you have a difficult task, but I think a constitutional amendment is the format to go forward with any changes to this, so that you bring the public with you and we have a solution that will last and not be a source of continuous conflict. I'd be glad to try and answer any questions. The system is the one thing in state government that is held out by virtually everywhere else as a great success.
Thank you. Questions for Senator Halford?
And I wouldn't mind asking him, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, please, Senator Coghill.
Rick, thank you for your testimony and your continued work down through the years for the people of Alaska. Establishing a constitutional right has got my attention, and it's going to be in kind of a juxtaposition maybe of the first article in our Constitution where the government is the people, and now you're going to create an individual right that is a payout. Give us some concept of how you would see that either landing or where we might want to think, you know, seriously about creating an individual constitutional right to an income stream.
Well, I think, number one, your question is a good, serious question that should be considered. But I think there are ways to deal with it. The creation of an individual right to a specific formula and so forth has some difficulties and at least raises some tax questions. But I think the way you put it together, you could, for example, and this all goes in the context of either the existing management system or the arguments for or against the POMV or whatever the management system is. But if you, for example, said that the real income of the fund, that's over inflation, would be divided between, your policy decision was the real income would be divided between government and equal distribution to citizens, you could state it in a different way. You could say that no more may be drawn from the reserve account for government operations than is equal to the amount that is paid out in dividends. That doesn't make the dividend an individual entitlement. And if you decide not to draw anything out and not to have a dividend, you just increase and bulk up the fund itself because it stays there. But you maintain some semblance of control, but you recognize that the incentive to make the system work is, of course, to have equal amounts come out for both state operations and for dividends after inflation is taken care of by a real income standard.
Well said. Thank you. I'll ponder that. No, I think, you bring some good points. I need to ponder those things. And I wasn't trying to be flippant with my questions. It really enters into kind of a constitutional area that we just haven't gone before. And it's very different to have a constitutional right than it is to have a statutory entitlement. So I'll take that into consideration, do some homework on it.
Additional questions for Senator Halford, who's online. Senator Halford, this is Senator Dunleavy. I have two questions. My view of history, and correct me, or at least tell me if it's different from yours, is that the fund was set up to save wealth for future generations in perpetuity, and that the dividend came along a little later, but was a good idea. Again, I use the analogy sometimes that it's kind of like chaining a Rottweiler, the people of Alaska, to the doghouse, which is the permanent fund. But do you believe that the government still has a right to a portion of the earnings?
Well, I think the government has whatever rights it takes. It's a compact between those elected and the people, and as They went back to the federal constitution. It's the consent of the governed that eventually is in control. Of course, our system has been very peaceful in that exercise of control, and that's the way we want it to always be. But, the state of Alaska spent 9/10 of the greatest resource wealth in North American history on a population very small in a very short period of time, one generation. And those of us who were all here were all a part of that, be it good or bad. But a little bit has been saved for the future. And I kind of view the permanent fund as a trust to the future. There were huge arguments as to whether it should be a loan fund, a capital budget fund. There were lots of alternative uses, and they all failed. Many thought it was to be an endowment to the bureaucracy. But the bottom line, and Elmer Rasmussen expressed it best in the early permanent fund papers when he said, you know, we went out and we had hearings all over the state, and we went nationally and listened to people's suggestions, but we came up with no conclusion except the negative purpose that the permanent fund was to take money off the table so it wouldn't be spent. But there was no agreement on anything else. So the dividend was one of the ideas out there. State loans was another of the ideas out there. The endowment of bureaucracy was another of the ideas out there. Hammond was very specific in his last book, saying that the permanent fund was not intended to be a rainy day fund. But that was his opinion. There were people who did want it to be a rainy day fund. And it's now 35 or 40-year-old history. And I think Elmer's logic was probably the best in that he said we couldn't get to agreement as to what the purpose was except the agreement to take it off the table because of the perception of excess spending.
One last question. What do you think the value of the fund would be today if there was never a dividend?
I'm afraid it would be zero, because if there hadn't been a dividend, the fund would have gone into the breach in the 80s, and again, and whatever was there would have been spent. Every one of the authorities that has looked back and said, why is our fund different than all the others, has basically said that the dividend was the strongest protection. There's a whole list of protections in Dave Rose's book in terms of other sources of loans, so that took the pressure off, and the fact that we had money, the fact that it wasn't tax money taken from one person to give to another, but it was common resource wealth, so it followed on with the whole concept of the owner-state. Those things were all part of what gelled from no one individual's idea, but to something that has become a worldwide example.
Senator, were you surprised at the veto this past year?
Yes, I was, because I thought it was impossible. Frankly, I still do, and of course I'm a plaintiff in that case. But it was very clear in the last couple years of the Hammond administration, there were legal opinions. There were the only dividend that needed to be appropriated was the first one, because it came from the general fund, and it was a fairly large sum of money. But other than that, the appropriation language is informational, but it's not required. It's a belt and suspenders. The law is not like most of the laws you pass today. When you pass a law that requires appropriation, you say subject to appropriation. There's no language in the dividend law that says subject to appropriation. It is a dedication specifically allowed for in the constitutional amendment that created the permanent fund. And the debate in committee, they actually changed the proposal and added the language unless otherwise provided by law, because they wanted to be able to use permanent fund income to dedicate to a loan package or to a financing package for a big industrial development or other things. They wanted flexibility that no other money through the general fund has.
In your opinion, do you view this attempt by Senator Wilkowski to constitutionalize the concept as unfinished business?
Well, I think it is unfinished business, but we have all learned a lot in the last 40 years, hopefully. And I know that I went along with things that I wish I hadn't 25 or 30 years ago, and there were other things I thought we went the right direction on. But it is the evolution of what it takes to defend a system, and it's a complete system. It's the management structure. It's the investment rules. It's the dividend. It's the inflation proofing. It's a complete system that works. If you look at all the other huge funds at low oil prices, they're spending their principal. The Saudis have spent billions and billions of dollars, and the other big one in Norway has come down tens of billions of dollars as well.
I was going to ask you another question because as you were speaking, I was thinking of Kazakhstan. They just came out with a report last week that their sovereign wealth fund is heading south pretty rapidly because there's total access to the fund by the government. One last question, and it truly is one last question for this session, but if the constitutional amendment, the resolution is allowed to go to the people for a vote, what do you think the outcome will be?
It depends what it says. I was a part of a group that offered a constitutional proposal, and we passed it out of the Senate to the House. It included a constitutional spending limit, a breakdown of permanent fund income. At that time, it was proposed to be 40% dividends, 30% in the state government, 30% inflation proof, called 40-30-30, and the constitutional budget reserve. The House passed back the constitutional budget reserve and never dealt with the other two. But I think a long-term solution is going to require public participation. And I think if people get the security of a dividend that's constitutional in a way that doesn't endanger the tax status or anything else, if they get that security, I think they may accept a little different formula than they have now. But that's what you who are there today have to figure out what people's tolerance and interest is. I know that I would support something that had the constitutional certainty and could contribute something to state government. You can't get the whole solution from one of the sources, but you can get a big piece of it. That's why the permanent fund has such a big reserve, because it makes more than it uses, even if the dividend were fully paid and inflation were fully handled.
Thank you. Any questions for Senator Halford? Seeing none, we may ask you back. At this point, we're going to put the bill aside and give folks some time to think about it, and I'm sure that Senator Wilkowski will provide us with some runs and maybe some charts, and we'll have conversations with folks about potential language changes, and then we'll pick this bill up again. So are there any closing comments from members of the committee? With that, we're going to adjourn, and our next meeting is next Tuesday at 3:30. And we'll be hearing SB 48, Insurance for Dependents of Deceased Fire Police, SJR 2, Constitutional Appropriation Limit, and then we'll be taking up the permanent fund bills in the following meeting on Thursday. With that, we're adjourned.